This is the fear of science.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to The Fear of Science, the podcast that dives into the wide world of science topics and science-adjacent topics to demystify, debunk, and delight. Each show features a new science fear, along with special guests, surprises, and discoveries along the way. My name is Daniel Chai.
And I'm Jeff Porter.
And we are at the beautiful Vancouver Public Library Inspiration Lab for our one-year anniversary podcast episode.
Woo! Even though technically it's not 1 year right now at all, but when this episode comes out, it will be exactly 1 year.
Yes, we've been doing this. We are still eating cake today, though. So. And joining us for this episode, which is episode 23, we have two special guests here to talk about today's fear, which is the fear of nature. Fear of nature. Now, as a self-described city boy, sometimes nature does scare me. So I'm very glad to have our guest here.
Yeah, I understand that. I think I'm a pretty self-described city boy, too.
Right.
Even though I grew up in rural Manitoba, I feel like I'm still a city boy. The town I grew up in was 1,200 people, but I'm still a city boy.
Wow. Well, here to work us through our fear of nature and maybe teach us a little bit more about what nature is all about, we have our two special guests. Please introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Go ahead. I'm Sean Michaels. I love the forage. I'm an amateur forager. I work professionally for Parks Board, City of Vancouver. There I work with the urban forestry and I have a private tree service.
Cool. Excellent.
And I'm Robin Court. I'm the owner of Swallowtail Culinary Adventures. We love to take kids and families out into the forest and sort of teach them about nature, basically, so what they can eat. I'm a chef and a sommelier, so that's the sort of angle I'm taking in the forest. Is like, is it yummy? And if it's not, I don't care.
Right. Excellent. Now, so we are here in Vancouver, listeners from around the world. Vancouver is a very, very natural, beautiful place. So we're very lucky to have lots of nature around us. But every once in a while, I will meet people who have lived there all their lives. And, I mentioned, Stanley Park or hikes around Metro Vancouver. And a number of people will tell me, even though they've lived here for years, they've never explored Stanley Park. They've never gone up the grass grind. And it's almost like they're not necessarily afraid, but almost like there's no draw in it for them. And
I was
like, what?
I have a confession to make. I've never done the grouse grind, and
shame.
I don't want to.
Yeah, no, I don't either, though, and I still like to forage.
So for our guests, why perhaps are some people, perhaps like yourselves, super into nature, and yet some other people are almost like ambivalent towards nature?
For myself, I have to say I've always felt comfortable with nature. I feel like I'm in the embrace of nature. I don't feel fear or concern to be out and around all the things that are just there.
Did you grow up in Vancouver?
No, actually, I grew up all across Canada. And in fact, my first mushroom forage was in Swan River, Manitoba.
Oh, really?
Near Duck Mountain.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, I was nine.
Oh, I know Swan River.
The beginning.
Yeah. Very cool. Sometimes I think, for me, it started with my family. So my dad took me out into the forest and with a tree book when I was young, right? So it was like, how to identify Douglas fir, we grew up in the West End, so I'm a city girl, right? But I had Stanley Park, and Stanley Park is, as far as parks, it's pretty big, right?
It's totally walking
distance.
It's the biggest.
It's the biggest
in the world.
Really?
The biggest urban forest park in the world. Yeah.
Holy.
I thought you were going to say it's the biggest Stanley Park in the world.
It is that too.
Did you know there's a Stanley Park in Calgary?
Really?
Yes.
There will be.
Don't fact check that.
Stanley Cup.
But yeah, it's like, so, you know, and my dad was from Manitoba as well.
Oh,
so,
what?
Yeah.
I did not do that on purpose, just invite a bunch of Manitoba.
Well, I was going to say, I just have to clarify. I wasn't born here in Vancouver, but I was born in Rivers Inlet. My dad was a logger, and I started in this world on a logging camp. So very much
you're in the forest.
Isolated in the forest, old growth forest. And certainly, I think that's why there is no fear in my world.
Yeah, it's like your home.
Yeah, yeah, really, very comfortable.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are, you know, I've read things online of people who, you know, there are people who claim to be allergic to technology and allergic to, you know, Wi-Fi signals and a certain piece of technology that we have around us all the time. So those people then go and live in nature to try, or like communes almost, to escape it. I guess that's the opposite side.
Yeah.
It's like the need of nature.
Is there the opposite of like a technophobe? Is there a nature-a-phobe? Is that a thing?
Has to be a thing.
I Googled, I did my research, and normally whenever I do the research for the subject, I type in whatever the subject is, and there's usually some kind of phobia name attached to it, but there is no...
Is there none?
Fear of nature phobia.
Because, you know, there's like fear of sharks, fear of spiders, fear of lightning, you know.
I think
there's got to be a fear of fungus, though.
Oh, definitely. It's called microphobia.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
So they've broken it down into pigeon poop, is what they've done.
That's pretty much what it is. Yeah, there's just so many that they're like, oh, we got it covered.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Now, for our special guests, you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. You know, we're sitting in a beautiful inspiration lab, but it's a building. What do I need nature for? If I stay in a building and I never see a tree or natural light again, they have seasonal affective disorder lamps. What do I need nature for? What does nature give us? Such a big question.
It is a huge question. I'm... Yeah. Do you want to take that one?
Oh, I can start it. Okay. I hope you tag team it.
Yeah, sure.
That's a big one. I could not be without nature. Like, I really do have to be outside. So I have a hard time answering that in a solid way. Outside, it feeds your soul. And I can't imagine being disconnected. I can't imagine being that this would be my world right here and I would never see a tree again. That would be shocking to have that cross my mind.
Yeah, and so as an example, so my my good friend, who is a total nature phobe, like we went out to a cabin. They're everywhere. They're all around me. Went out to a cabin on Harrison Lake, and you know, we were out there for 2 days, and we had to boat to the little cabin. It was this cute little cabin in the beautiful forest, and you got a lake to swim in. And on the day we left, he was at the dock with all his luggage, you know, packed, sort of thing, and just waiting for that boat. So, really? There's people. I understand they exist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, even for him, it's like he wanted to go out and sort of get close. That was too isolating for him.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the people that I take out on tours are in Stanley Park, in UBC Farms, you know, North Shore Mountains sort of thing, that's an accessible nature. So that's like baby steps for people that are a little bit afraid. And I think what it does is it totally does, you know, bring them out of their computer, out of that hum of electricity that's around you and the stress that's involved in that, you know?
Do you find that it's a lot of people who are kind of wanting to get out of their technology bubble and get into nature that come? Or is it more the people who are really stoked about nature and just want to learn more, or both?
It's both. It's like, I would say it's 20% total keeners that are like, you know, they're already foraging for a ton of things and they want to know specifically about bracken fern or something, mm-hmm. right? And then the rest of it is people with their kids that just want to, they're looking for that connection to nature, mm-hmm. and they are afraid, so they want someone to sort of soothe them into it and sort of, you know, go out with a guide that, you know, can teach them about it's also about sparking interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a mushroom right? When you look at a lobster mushroom, it's like bright red, it smells like seafood, and you've never looked at it before. Because usually just like, you know, you're going about your business, you're getting in the car or going to work, right?
Yeah. Do we think that children, the next generation, are becoming more nature phobic?
I think the potential's there just because our new experience, we call it connecting, but it really seems to be an experience of disconnecting. You know, we really dive into our phones all the time, myself included as well. But I think, especially foraging, to go and find food in its most basic primal form and primal way, I can't think of a more natural, stronger connection for someone to have. I may have strayed from that answer, but I think the potential is there to disconnect, but I think too that technology offers some opportunities to really engage with nature. Like there are some amazing apps on the subject of identifying almost any kind of plant or mushroom or genre of food that you might want. There's great networking with foraging.
Facebook. Yeah, groups.
But for example, there's an app called Forager. And you can directly connect with that as a forager, with buyers, with chefs. And so these opportunities are there. I think that if our newer experiences were engaged properly, maybe with a little discipline or care, that it could really open nature. But mm-hmm. there is that other side, Facebook and things we can disappear into and disconnect from nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one thing that technology has taught me about nature, and that's thanks to Minecraft, I learned that by punching a tree, I can get wood.
That's how it works.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
That's how you hurt your knuckles last time.
So for those who don't know, we've touched upon it a little bit. What is foraging? And is foraging that something that people do for themselves or as a business or for restaurants? What are there different types of foraging?
I know this one. He's an X-Man. He was.
No, that's Forge.
Oh, that's Forge. Okay, sorry.
He's really good at building stuff. X-Men shout out. But what is Forge?
I think Robin is really for that one.
I'm like jumping at the bit. So foraging is lots of different things. As a chef, the reason I really got into foraging was because I wanted to go out and try to find the taste of the Pacific Northwest, because we have so many cultures here. We don't really have a specific cuisine, right? So the taste of our place is our fir tips and our chanterelles and the things that grow here naturally to me, right? And to learn about that and to incorporate it into my cooking, that's how I started foraging. Whereas, you know, there's sustenance survivalist foraging. So the zombie apocalypse will be coming, of course, right? Everyone must be prepared, right?
There'll be some kind of apocalypse. I don't know about zombies, but...
Something. Some reason that you'll need to, you know, the electricity's gone, the supermarkets are gone, and what can you eat? Can you survive? I mean, to answer that small question, first you need the zombie apocalypse to happen in spring so that you can forage with the seasons. If it's in winter, I'm dead as well. So
so if the post-apocalyptic scenario is Snowpiercer, we're all done. But anything else, we're still good.
Yeah, good to go.
Foraging is? For myself, foraging actually was two things. I had a fear of doctors at a very young age. I had to see a lot of them.
And that will be episode 38.
And actually, I came across a herbal, and I realized in this herbal, there was all these remedies and things, and it clicked in my head at about 8 years old. It's like, well, if I learn this, I won't have to see the doctor. So that's really how it started initially. But then I felt it for myself, it was a way to reconnect culturally, because I'm Métis, but we weren't very connected. And so just the exploration of plants, food sourcing, to me, that's been the strongest to tie back into that experience.
Now, is foraging, I think you mentioned this before, but is foraging something to be done all year round, or are there certain seasons? Is it just for mushrooms, or are there other types of foraging?
Oh, there's a full spectrum. Close to year round, but certainly the wintertime it gets pretty scarce. I mean, you have to know.
It's not bad in Vancouver, at least. I guess, far as Canada is concerned, you could dig some sword fern roots or something if you were desperate, right?
You certainly have to know your plants and things before the experience. And I think that's maybe where people don't necessarily prepare, or they think it'll be easy. I'm not sure what goes on, but nonetheless, you can forage year-round. You can roots, potting herbs, berries, mushrooms.
Sea foraging. Seaweeds. That is the key to survival. If
Manitoba,
this goes down,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, Manitoba.
Manitoba foraging in the winter
done.
Is horrible.
They're done. You do not want to be there.
The LG in Winnipegosis doesn't count.
No, totally.
So say if Jeff and I we ended up doing an episode of Naked and Afraid. Where we got dropped into the middle of a forest do they give you like a knife?
Can we say this show alone instead of Naked and Afraid? Why do I have to be naked for this?
That has to be. What are some tips that perhaps like Jeff and I can remember if we're out in a forest, a nice generic forest that we can use to survive in said nature when looking for food?
I think personally, number one, mushroom, really easy to identify, witch's butter. It's a very unusual, peculiar, yellow, bubbly mushroom. It's a jelly mushroom. It kind of looks like a human brain about the size.
Like
of
an alien.
Yeah. Mm. And it
sounds so appetizing.
Yeah.
It's one of the few mushrooms that you can actually eat raw, right off of the wood or the ground. Even a lot of edible mushrooms you can't eat raw. You have to prepare them. But that one, you can eat raw. And it's almost entirely carbohydrate and electrolytes.
What?
That will keep you alive. And most importantly, you'll be able to make good decisions, because it's bad decisions that kill you.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
And it's true that mushrooms that have that are like red and like crazy colors avoid?
No, not at all. Like lobster mushrooms, the ones I was telling you about, that are bright red and beautiful and taste like seafood and are amazing, they're bright red. Yeah.
Spotted? If there are spotted mushrooms in like, is there a general, where's like a no?
There's no blanket rules.
Oh,
I wouldn't say. Do you have blanket
we're
rules?
We're going to die in the nature
no,
while we're naked.
Not, yeah. Like, there's
for
no
mushrooms.
There's no real color code.
I can't get Wi-Fi, so I can't Google if I can eat this mushroom.
And in fact, some of the most peculiar mushrooms that you would be sure, intuitively, you're sure that's poisonous, turn out to be some of the most palatable, sought-after mushrooms ever.
Well, aren't the
cauliflower mushrooms?
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Those are so good. They look like a brain.
Huge.
They're white.
Brain.
Oh.
Yeah. Aren't the white cap mushrooms or something like that?
Death
caps, ones that just...
Those look like button mushrooms a little bit, right?
Yeah,
oh, let's try.
That's how I would die. I would eat something that is the worst thing possible for me to eat.
And they grow in urban areas, so that's even more likely for people to trip upon them.
Yeah, I'd get one of the psychedelic mushrooms and just trip out for days.
Yeah.
No, thanks. I was going to say, for myself and my usual foraging, the fear of the death cap really... isn't there. It's come through imported trees. It may in the future make its way out into our forests, but right now I feel pretty confident I could go out into my usual places and never come across one. It'll be here within the limits of the city.
Oh, really?
That you'll find that, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're foraging in the forest, you're safer than in the city.
Yeah.
Really?
There you go, city boy.
You certainly have to know a few more things. At the very least, I mean, we have over 400 different species of foreign trees here on our streets.
Yeah.
And they did come from Europe quite often. So these types of mushrooms could easily have found their way that way. And that's why they didn't. You won't find them in our forests. You'll find them in our immediate area within the city.
Yeah, so it's a better classroom actually out in the forest, where things are more limited as to what you'll find.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a, you know, you're talking about simple rules and that sort of thing. So when I teach people, it's, I mean, the rule number one is like, when in doubt, throw it out.
Yeah, that's my
thing. Right? Absolutely. It's number one. It's like, if you don't know, then don't do it, right? But, you know, another thing is just to keep what you're interested in. Let's say you're interested in foraging for mushrooms, right? Pick a few mushrooms that don't have any poisonous lookalikes, like a chanterelle. You could go to Whole Foods, buy a chanterelle, and go hiking with it. And then, you know, compare in the forest, right?
Oh, if only there was a Whole Foods in the middle of the forest.
But right. Simple, right? Yeah. You just like stay away from the poisonous ones. There aren't a huge amount of poisonous things in our forest. Most things you could cram in your mouth and you'd be like, they won't do anything for you or against you, right? Oh.
I think it's also important to define poison. Poison, the term is often used, but when you break down kind of what that actually means in the mushroom world, well, poisoning could mean it gave you upset stomach, maybe caused you to vomit, maybe other versions. And then you do, of course, get to a few that, yes, when you eat them, you'll eventually die and there is no cure or antidote for the problems.
But they're very few amounts.
Very, very few amounts. Yeah, like, I guess that's, from the disconnect, we feel like 90% of the things are poisonous, when in fact 90% of the things won't kill you. Maybe only 20% of the things actually taste good, and the other things just,
who cares?
You don't want to eat them.
They're too woody.
There's no flavor. Yeah. It's a bad flavor. Yeah. It's bitter.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's your guide.
Yeah.
But what would actually just kill you stone dead? It's pretty limited.
And if you learn those first, right?
There's a good
learn lesson. About the death cap, right? You know, just study it. It kind of, you know, and it'll make you just aware of the most important things.
Or take a tour out at Swallowtail.
Yes, take a tour with me. I happily teach people. Yeah.
And really, that is one of the best ways, because the mushrooms that Robin's been describing, like the lobster mushroom, some of the hedgehogs, like there's a whole variety. There's about 18 that we pick as well, and you know they don't have an evil cousin that will kill you. Like they just don't. And once you've learned to identify that mushroom and all the things about it, you really won't forget it. The perception, I think, is that you would have to learn 50,000 mushroom types, but really it's about 15 to 20 types that you're only interested in, and
I think
you
really
overlook the rest.
It's education, too, right?
Like, 100%.
It's never a good idea just to go out into anything and just start eating.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
I recommend not doing that in any situation.
No.
Don't wander around this library and just start eating what you see.
Books, or yeah.
So as well as, learning about different food types and things in nature, speaking of the education aspect, what do we feel are some ways that we can learn how to encourage, ourselves and people that we know and future generations to, start loving and respecting nature? I feel that somewhere, I try to recycle.
Flashbacks to the fear of climate change here.
Oh, yeah, sure. I love paper straws. I saw someone recently on Facebook post a thing being like, boo, paper straws. And I'm like, unless you're drinking like the same thing for like 4 hours in a row, you are not going to be needing a paper straw that lasts forever.
Yeah.
So.
Well, actually, as an addition to that straw thing, there's someone at the farmer's market that's selling sweet sisal straws. So that's a wild plant that the stem is hollow, and it tastes sort of sweet and lightly like licorice.
Wow.
Beautiful idea,
that's
right?
A straw?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Wow.
I was at a coffee shop the other day, and they now have sugar cane straws as well.
Of course, yeah.
Brilliant. So as well as teaching us, hey, nature is helpful for us by being our straws. what are some other ways that we feel could be good to reconnect with nature, other than just turning off our phones?
Yeah.
Other ways? I have to go back to foraging and that sort of thing, because I can't imagine anything more natural, more basic, more fundamental than a human being going into the forest and looking for food. I mean, that's got to be obviously one of the very first things we did as having a human experience. And I think by having that experience, it's inevitable that you connect. But it's inevitable that you would connect with, in a sense, the web of life. You become conscious of the weather. You become conscious of moisture content. You become conscious of all the things that have to do with your favorite thing that you like to forage. If it's berries or whatever that is, you become connected in so many other ways because of that little piece of food.
Where is your happy place? Like, do you have a specific like outdoor place that you can immediately, if you need to be calm or if you're looking forward to going back somewhere? Where's your happy place?
They're not gonna tell us because then everyone's gonna go there.
I can confirm I have a happy place. I have a few of them. I could say they're from Horseshoe Bay to Lions Bay.
but it's outdoors.
Or garden, right? Like my backyard, you know, for people that are more afraid of going out into the forest, right? It's like there's lots of really cool edible weeds in your backyard that you don't have to pull and throw dandelions. Yeah, right. Yep. So I have a recipe for dandelion marmalade that you serve that with duck, and it's just absolutely amazing. I use dandelion in place of radicchio. So recipes with radicchio that have that bitter component, like marmalade and stuff, right?
And what about sorrel?
Sorrel, quarter,
like totally. The potting herbs and stuff. Like I actually walk over them every day in my works yard, to and from the truck. Like they're everywhere you look. There really is
food everywhere.
You pay attention.
Totally. Like good food, not.
Yeah.
I think the way to get people outside for their own good and for that, you know, that reconnection aspect that we're talking about is through their stomachs. Because if you're a city person, you know, a lot of people, everyone likes food, right? Like everyone wants to get and try the new thing or the, you know. So, I mean, I really believe like that's the angle I've been trying to work anyway.
I have a hunch too, every forager. If they're not, they become a foodie.
Mm-hmm.
It just is inevitable. You start imagining different sauces with all these new foods.
Saskatoon berries or whatever. And huckleberries.
Of course, the flavors are amazing when you are foraging the food right off the plant, fresh. There's nothing else like it.
Yeah.
I do want to say, though, I think it's important to understand kind of maybe genres of foraging. You touched on survival foraging, but there's medicinal foraging. There's more than just simply what goes on your plate.
Right.
And it does cover the saying of, you know, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. Like, foraging covers off so many things beyond just food.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I was going to ask as well, is there any legal stuff around foraging, especially in the city? Can you just go out and just like, or even going out to Stanley Park, can you just go out to Stanley Park and just pick a bunch of mushrooms? Is that cool?
Technically, no. The parks really are off limits. I would suggest, though, that there are some parks that I think at the very least, you could well acquaint yourself with great varieties of food plants in robust amounts, and you can see them in all their ages. And that, like Everett Crowley, for example. So Stanley Park is the jewel of the city. Foraging probably shouldn't be done there at all. Just let it go. But there are other parks that are being highly developed. They're under constant change. That change is also promoting quite a spectrum of ongoing plants, mushrooms continually. They are dog parks. So to be honest, I'm not going to say you can and should, because that's also not my pay grade.
Yeah.
But I think that in those areas, it certainly would be acceptable. But back to your legalities, the parks may be off limits. There's private land and things like that. So I think if you start foraging, just be conscientious of where you are. You know, you don't want to really be in someone's front lawn.
You'd have to ask them. So
You didn't post no foraging.
Yeah. I'm gonna pick your carrots. Sorry. No, but BC Parks are technically off limits. But when I've had discussions with BC Parks as well, they're okay with people picking berries and things that are sustainable to a degree. They want to leave enough there for animals that need to survive off those things. But there is a, you know, there is a leniency. And if anyone has questions about that, about where they can pick, because, for example, a lot of BC parks border on Crown land where you're allowed to pick, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people ask me, they're like, well, where does this Crown land begin, right? So, and it is a bit ambiguous. So if you have questions like that, that you can phone BC Parks. Basically, if there's an area you want to pick in, pinpoint it, phone them, and just check with them before you go.
Or just call Sean directly.
Yeah, call him, yeah.
Say his phone number at the end of the
right
show.
Right now, yeah.
But I would put forward a kind of a counterintuitive idea as well. I think the thought is when you forage, you're taking it away, and you're taking it away forever, and it's gone. If people also become conscientious as to how to forage, and each plant kind of has its own little details, which is part of the fun of learning, you can actually enhance it. Mm-hmm. One mushroom in particular, for example, oyster mushrooms, summer oyster mushrooms. If you come across them at the right time and you harvest all the mature ones and you come back 24 to 48 hours, there'll be a whole new flush.
Oh, wow.
Do it again. It'll keep going and going. But if you don't show up within 48 hours, that top row of oyster mushroom, the large mature one, will begin to collapse and it will fall over all the other young mushrooms underneath that were going to become adults.
Right.
But the top one, because it wasn't picked, rotted over the lower ones and it shuts down the whole flush.
Oh, wow.
That's what happened in elementary school when I wasn't picked. Yeah, that's a good point.
So foraging, my point directly is it can, done properly, can actually enhance and promote more of the food sourcing for others.
That's why people pick with baskets for mushrooms a lot of time, is the theory is the spores, then the seeds of the mushroom then can proliferate through the forest as you skip home, right?
And I can say for myself, because I have quite a specific pattern in places where I visit it regularly, and certainly in the beginning of my foraging in these territories, there were no one variety in particular, the yellowfoot, I really enjoy. And certainly the lower areas of the mountain range where I would begin my walks, the first 2 years had none whatsoever. But as I would walk back through those paths carrying netted bags full of these mushrooms, at this point they show up every year now. And I'm pretty convinced it's because I walk through that area. And
that's so cool.
You're just like a wood nymph.
Totally.
Everything's growing around.
He's Father Nature.
No, I think you get that. That's your title.
Question now. Normally, Jeff, it's at the end of the episode that we ask for social media. But I'm curious, are either of you on Instagram?
Yeah.
I am, actually, yes.
Nice.
Do you post your hashtag foraging photos?
Yes.
There we go. Because I was curious, because, you know, we're talking about, you know, the connection between nature and social media, and, you know, how can we as a modern society still be able to connect, right? And just the hashtag foraging has over 678,000 hashtags.
Wow.
And some of these photos are as psychedelic as I'm sure they will make me feel. Listeners, I'm holding the photo up to the microphone so you can see exactly.
That's not how podcasts work.
This is apparently a rhodotus. It's red. It's gorgeous.
Wow, it is gorgeous.
And it has 6,400 likes on Instagram.
If you eat that one, you grow larger, I believe.
Oh, right? Yeah. I actually put mine on Facebook.
He puts his on Facebook.
I put mine on Facebook.
Yeah.
Do you have a fan page?
No, just my name.
Oh, nice.
If you friend me, I'll friend you back.
Yeah,
or however that actually works.
Yeah.
And I usually... Yeah, once a week I'll post something that I forage.
Cool.
Although, I do graffiti.
Wow.
I learned when I was researching information about you for this episode, that's not easy to find information on you because there's another famous Shawn Michaels out there.
He's my security guard. No, it's my protection. You never find me on the internet.
That's hilarious.
And then I was like, I'm pretty sure it's not that Shawn Michaels.
I'm pleasantly surprised and a little disappointed.
I think you would have gone into full on fanboy mode.
It would have been me talking the entire time.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. It is Shawn Michaels, the wrestler. No one can see this. No one knows.
So, Jeff, you know, a question for you and also for you as well. What are your happy places in nature? Do you have ones either here in Vancouver where we are recording or elsewhere? Do you have a place where you like to connect with nature?
Oh, I'm a bad person to ask that. I am not a nature-a-phobe, this new phobia that we've made up. But I am not the greatest at getting into nature, for sure. I'm a big fan of video games and sitting inside playing D&D. So,
well, D&D campaigns, inevitably you end up in a forest.
That's true, yeah. I mentally go into nature all of the time. Every Sunday. Wow. It's this area for Rune called.
For myself, I think, you know, here, one place that it's a beautiful place in East Vancouver, Trout Lake. Trout Lake. You know, it has, like, when you're by the lake and you're not too close to the parking lots, it really does feel like you're in, like, nature. And, like, and there's a lake... of course, right now, as we're recording this, it has E. coli problems. But other than that...
Every year.
But other than that, you know, it's a great place for dogs, and it has a beach, and there's you know, a lake in the middle of the city, and I love it.
Well, another great place, too, a couple other great places is if you're in the city...
come visit.
Yeah, UBC Botanical Gardens are incredible.
UBC Farms.
Yeah, UBC Farms.
Jericho Park, that area has lots of, like, a little marsh area you can walk in with tons of different biodiversity in there.
Yeah, Van Dusen as well. There's so many just beautiful areas in the city that you can get into nature without really leaving the city at all.
Yeah.
And UBC Botanical Gardens actually has an entire area in their physics garden that's all about different plants and that could actually kill you or cool. You know,
it's neat stuff. Like, even so, if you're into like D&D or whatever, like, the, you know, if you have more of, you know, and zombie apocalypse and stuff like that, it's like there's so many interesting things about these poisonous plants, these weird mushrooms and these strange things, you know, and that's the interest for people sometimes too, right? It's like, you know, if you really... What foraging does is it makes you slow down, walk very slowly through a patch. It could be a Trout Lake, could be up in the mountains, right? And really analyze what's around you. And when you stop and do that, people, like on my tours, they just like, they'll start looking down and be like, oh, that was right there, you know, that bright orange mushroom with the red snail eating it or this weird spider or whatever, right? It's sort of like a little world that you're missing all the time.
That makes me want to slow down in my D&D campaign. Instead of fast travel, let's just slow down and forage in D&D world.
These campaigns would take hours. Forever. For yourself, Robin, do you have a place that you like to go to?
For sure. Like, me and my partner just got some bear land on Galliano Island. So we're on the water there, and right now we're in a hunter's tent. So we're just starting to build a cabin eventually, right? But it's got this seaweed garden in front that I am just fascinated by. I can, like, look down on it and see, like, lion's mane jellyfish sort of, you know, swimming by and all these, like, beautiful green and yellow seaweeds that are, you know, seaweeds are great because a lot of them are edible and there's none that are deadly poisonous. So it's, like, a safe sort of ground for people.
Super nutritious.
Yeah, and we just don't eat seaweed. Yeah.
It's really good in poke as well.
I know, right? I know.
That's, you know, this conversation is it's a lovely reminder, Jeff, of why I enjoy these podcasts, because it's a place where we can get people geeking out about something that they're super and ultra passionate about. On recent episodes, we've had people geek out and share their passions about politics, about Bitcoin, and it's really nice to hear so much about a topic I knew very little about, foraging, and just to hear the passion, you know, from both of you is really awesome, and I can tell that people who get to work with you and go on your tours probably get a really cool experience.
That's the one thing is I'm able to geek out over a lot of things, but nature has always been one that I appreciate it. And I love it, and I love that it exists outside of the area where I am. My fiance and I always she loves to camp. I cannot.
Oh no!
That is my idea of torture. Is camping. I keep telling her that we're gonna have to do a lot of that during the apocalypse. So I'm just waiting till then, saving it all up.
That's fabulous. So my girlfriend Jenny and myself also we respect other people's enjoyment of camping, but we are good. So apologies, so sorry that you have a partner.
We'll not camp together. She's very good at going camping with her friends, not me.
Mild offshoot, but only because I read this story recently and it's fascinating me. The media, perhaps the media, Jeff, whether it be post-apocalyptic movies, fictionalized tales, or non-fiction stories like the one I'm going to mention, it contributes to people's fear of nature. For example, there's a slave-making ant.
There's
a slave-making ant, which is apparently rare, which has been found in a New Brunswick conservation area. It's a rare variety of ant known for enslaving another species of ant. A researcher spotted it. But apparently this slave-making ant is apparently a sign of healthy environment. Really? Apparently, according to the researcher, the fact that there is this slave-making ant there, that means that there's enough ants for this slave-making ant
to enslave.
If we're talking humans, that's
so
not
cool,
a good thing,
right? Nature is cool.
If you have an environment that is able to support more ant species, you're having a healthier soil system. You have a more stable ecosystem in general, according to this researcher named Fairweather, which makes sense. Aaron Fairweather, a doctoral candidate at the University of Guelph.
Well, that's some research you got there.
Yeah. Just because I'm like, the fact that there are slave-making ants
there,
why do we lock the doors?
So are there a lot of, really tiny pyramids that keep getting built?
It's just a puddle that gets split in two. The parting of a puddle.
That's the other thing about nature, though. I was just reminded me of, I was canoeing in that Galliano area, and all the rock formations in the seaweed have this crazy sort of pockmarked streaky quality to them that make them look like a Geiger paintings. So a lot of our sci-fi and a lot of our video games are based off these cool things like that ant in nature, right? And it's like if you go for a little walk and just stare down the ground, you could have some of that inspiration for yourself for your next campaign.
Yeah. Are you saying without nature I wouldn't have video games?
Yes. Totally.
Didn't Star Trek just produce a series with mushroom technology?
Oh, they sure did.
Science
Polystands.
Spore Drive. Spore Drive and Discovery. I mean, I have no idea what you're talking about. But,
Spore Drive?
Oh, yeah.
It's brilliant.
So, it's not, I was going to say no spoilers, but it's not, it's like right at the beginning. But yeah, no, Spore Drive technology.
Wow.
You need nature.
I'm happy to learn that thousands of years in the future, there are still mushrooms. Mushrooms are very hardy though, right? Right, and they can grow in almost.
Depends on the type. I think there's a lot of research being done, for example, of using mushrooms to detoxify land of various pollutants, possibly types of radiation. Like, for example, around Chernobyl, I saw a program not too long ago, the foraging around Chernobyl, and how the food is actually within reasonable radiation counts, except the mushrooms.
Really?
They absorb higher counts of it. In fact, too, survival foraging, lichen used to be high on the list to scrape off and make tea. It's been taken off the the list because it absorbs radiation.
Right.
So you shouldn't take that in.
And now we've mentioned Chernobyl, so we're going to get that all that Chernobyl traffic.
Yeah.
But they can be used to clean up some pretty serious problems.
Right.
And
wow.
In other ways, they're an indicator that the environment might be pure because otherwise they couldn't be there.
Right.
They're like an integral part of the cycle for sure, right?
And a large amount of nature is going to survive with or without us.
Well, yeah. Better without us in some ways.
Yeah.
Dandelions will be sad, though.
See, back to the mushroom idea and being the intrinsic part of everything, I think you could easily liken the mushroom mycelium to being the equivalent or parallel to your nervous system in your body.
Yeah.
It is the wiring. It is the network of the forest.
Isn't the largest organism in the world a mushroom?
Yes.
It has like the giant roots that connect.
Football field size thing.
That's crazy.
I think it's actually in into the hectares. I read it. I'm not even going to quote the size because it seems too fantastical.
It's
but
gigantic.
Look it up and read it yourself.
Honey mushroom.
It will shock you. I mean, a woman, mycologist, wandered through forests for summers sampling honey mushrooms in this particular forest, and she was able to show that every one of those mushrooms came from a fruiting body, the same fruiting body. It was all the same DNA
organism.
It could be shown, and she was walking through a forest.
Wow.
So again, look that up, look at the size, shock yourself. It's the largest organism on the planet.
Very cool.
Before this episode, I enjoyed mushrooms on burgers. But now I'm super fascinated about mushrooms and nature. We did our job.
Convert.
Now, for every episode at the very end, I go to Twitter and I'll type in whatever our subject is and try to find some stuff on it. So I looked up, I didn't look up the hashtag nature, that's just way too much stuff, but looking up what some of the fears are. And a lot of the stuff that kind of came up, especially with recent news, is earthquakes and natural disasters. There was an earthquake in Nepal recently. And there was one just outside of Seattle, wasn't it last week?
Yeah.
Just a small one. Natural disasters. How screwed are we in Vancouver if the big earthquake happens? And do either one of you have your plan,
earthquake
your post-apocalyptic plan?
Yeah, I certainly...
You do?
I certainly...
You've got your kit?
I've got kits.
Wow, you're good.
Multiple.
I've got places that are just like...
Follow this guy.
Where's your underground bunker?
It's right underneath the Nelson Canyon overpass.
Oh, wow.
It's a hardened bunker.
Oh, geez.
50 people.
Wow. You're
planning. I'm keeping your number.
Totally.
I think actually that might be part of maybe a renewed interest in foraging, because I think, quite honestly, we talk and joke about it, but I think we all have in the back of our head that, things could really go wrong. Things could go sideways. We are vulnerable. I mean, the fact is we have 2 weeks' worth of food in Safeway, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's if everybody lines up nicely. As soon as something goes wrong, people have their vans there, and they're buying everything off the shelves. And so if you're not there in the first 2 hours, there is no 2 weeks' worth of food.
Yeah.
Right.
It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that might be in the back of people's minds as a motivation, which, hey, if that works, that's fine, because I think whatever the motivation is to go out and try to engage with nature and forage, you'll have the full-blown experience. It'll become more than what you ever thought it was.
Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me want to learn more about foraging.
Yeah.
Now is the time. Yeah. Well, it's a sunny day. it's a great time, because... Most certainly when things go wrong, it's almost certainly at 3:00 in the morning in a rain and lightning storm.
Yeah.
It's everything is working against you, usually.
Yeah.
It is the reality. So, just
be
enjoy
prepared.
Nature.
Be
Fill
prepared.
Your bathtub immediately.
Yes.
How about you, Robin? Do you have a plan?
No. I'm not as organized. I'm sorry. I'm just not like I
grew up in a logging camp. That's how we lived. So it's not a leap.
It's gonna happen. No, I just I have in my head, I have knowledge, right? So that's a huge thing. If you can get some, like you're asking us, some basic rules of thumb that we couldn't communicate to you in this half an hour, right? But yeah, it's just like some basics of what you could eat. Again, the sea would be our resource, a huge resource. If you know how to, we're doing a sea foraging tour coming up because people are interested in what they can forage from the shores without a boat. Because so many Vancouverites don't have boats. It's kind of strange.
I have zero boats.
Yeah. We're actually just personally starting that adventure.
You are too.
Because we have little kayaks and things now. Cool. So it's obvious since we pull up to the shoreline how much
so
food
much
is
to
there.
Eat.
We've never really explored that side of it. So we've just begun foraging on the seashore. And certainly lots of good protein.
Tons.
Lots of good minerals.
Lots of seashells by the seashore right here.
Yep. Some you should eat and some you shouldn't. Again, the fear.
And actually, a little plug about mushrooms and during difficult times. If you do a little research, you'll find mushrooms generally have twice the protein as a steak.
Really?
A steak is 9% protein and mushroom is 18% protein.
Oh, what about a Beyond Burger?
It's beyond that. And usually the mushrooms will contain the more difficult vitamins and minerals that people, whether they're vegetarian or meat eaters, are almost always deficient in, and mushrooms fill that void. But in a survival situation, that is your protein.
Mm. Yeah.
If you can't hunt a deer... A mushroom will
or grab a fish.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't do either one of those things.
Well,
but I can pick
mushroom,
a mushroom.
If you saw a picture of a lobster mushroom, you could probably do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Screenshot.
Totally.
It would be one of the only ones I would suggest using the internet to identify, because I think that's important to maybe some clues about maybe rules of identification and things.
Yep.
Like, personally, I would not start at the internet level to identify anything. I'm a believer in field guides and following the keys within the field guide. Like, each one is a little different, but as long as you read those processes, and to have a book, to have a hard copy there present is far more certain than the internet. Like, using identifying apps for mushrooms, I've yet to have one successfully identify any mushroom. I wouldn't use them.
And the apocalypse
books
as well. The internet will not be great. The apocalypse.
No.
Books aren't battery powered.
So spotty.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi is down again.
Yeah.
Wow. That is Jeff, I learned so much that I didn't know I needed to know.
Yeah.
And now I'm inspired and still mildly afraid.
But... Are you going to sign up for some foraging tours?
Yeah, totally.
Well, I'm going out Saturday morning if you show up at my doorstep by 9.
There you go.
Nice.
Now, for more information on the both of you and the places that you represent and work with, where can people learn more about your stuff?
Oh, I think Robin should go with that one first.
So swallowtail.ca is my website, and all the sort of sea foraging things that we talked about. And we have one more wild plant tour August 10th coming up, so to learn the basics of either seashore foraging or wild plants. And then in fall, we have wild mushrooms, and we do that every Saturday and Sunday.
Swallowtail.ca.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I think I would be a little bit scarce, and maybe the best way to kind of connect would be through Facebook. Just use my name, connect with me, and I would connect.
Hopefully it's not the showstopper Shawn Michaels.
No, it's not
Mr. WrestleMania.
No.
You'll know you're
actually
in the wrong place.
Shawn T. Michaels.
Yeah.
You'll be able to make the very
go to the WWE website.
And you know, if anybody really wanted to go out and forage, learn, I'm keen. I like to be part of that. Even
so
participate
great
with Robin's situation. It sounds fantastic.
Collaborate.
Yeah,
yeah,
it would be awesome.
Bringing people together.
Yeah, no, this is great.
You know, this has been very, very heartening and very illuminating. Thank you both so much for coming on and sharing not just your knowledge, but your passions. And again, your passions are really coming through, and it's really great to hear here, and I know it's going to be the same for our listeners. Maybe one day, Jeff, we'll camp.
Yeah. Like outside of D&D, you mean?
Yes. And to find us when you are not outside, when you are back within Wi-Fi signal range after foraging in the forest, you can find Fear of Science on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and of course on Podbean and all of your favorite podcast players. And yeah, thanks all of you for listening. And again, happy anniversary! Yay! Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.